As we head into the holidays, we know there's one thing that all of us, no matter how different we are, can agree on. Holiday travel sucks. It doesn't matter how awesome the final destination is, how short the flight, or if you haven't seen your family and friends in decades. The minute you arrive at the airport, the first thought that goes through your head is something like, please, 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 let's just survive this day. And sure, airports are pretty awful and stressful. The food is bad, the flights are packed, everyone is cranky, but it's not like that airport itself has something against you. It's just some big, bland municipal building. It's not evil.
That is, until you start looking into Denver International Airport, the main hub to legions of conspiracy theorists who tell you that it's not just some building. With its weird art, strange history, and layout, DIA is a stronghold for the New World Order, housing alien crafts, satanic rituals, and a time capsule that could bring about the end of days. Welcome to Mad Scientist Hometown Horrors, Holiday Edition! Today, we catch a flight to areas unknown as we dig into the stories that surround Denver International Airport.
Jake, roll the tape!
Are you you've already traveled, right? You've already been into an airport.
I hate it so much.
The food is so abysmal. I can't even stand it.
For my day job, I travel all the time. And obviously during COVID, I haven't traveled that much. But we're starting to travel again in February. This last trip, actually, I wasn't in an airport. I actually drove. Which is slightly less terrible, but also still pretty, pretty terrible. It's just like, oh my God, airports are.
They just bring out the best in everyone.
If you're gonna get punched in the face by somebody as an adult, it's probably gonna happen in an airport.
It's probably
going to. People are just, they're mean. Everyone just fucking hates being there. Like, nobody wants
everyone's
to be.
Everyone's all keyed up.
Yeah, no one wants to be at the airport. Everyone just wants to be where they're going. And we've made it such an impossible scenario. Like yesterday, some dude's gun went off in Atlanta's airport and they were just like, yeah, he got away. His gun just went off. I have been through that airport. They wouldn't let me bring bottled water. had a gun and they just let him go. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. No, and I actually have just been flying in and out fairly frequently of Denver International Airport. And I can tell you, but first of all, that airport is ginormous and it just feels huge. And it's Southwest has actually also just implemented almost this entirely automated way of self-checking your own bag that they had just introduced when I got there. So, of course, it like breaks down repeatedly when I'm there. So I'm like, well, goodbye bag. See ya.
Well, it's also airports are sort of weird because they're sort of gargantuan. They've become more than just like, okay. If you think about other transportation places or modes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You think about stuff like a bus stop or even a bus terminal. Those are pretty simple. They're just, you know, you get in, you give your ticket to this, you know, to the person unfortunate enough to be working the till, you sit down, you wait for the bus, the train, it gets in and you leave.
Exactly.
But airports are these sort of gargantuan buildings that have all these like seemingly secret passages and walkways and stuff. There's, you know, it's this hub. It's like a hive almost. And
yes, I was going to say it's like a spiderweb, but a hive is a much better analogy. Yeah.
And for someone like me who doesn't really like big crowds of people and gets really anxious, mm-hmm. just generally, mm-hmm. but also especially when traveling, mm-hmm. when around so many people, and especially so many people who are ready to just murder anybody that says anything wrong to them. Airports are really kind of a frightening place because, you know, it's the closest we get to like a Minotaur's lair in our modern lives outside of like going on one of those weird, like, you know, Wipeout game shows or whatever. It's the closest we get.
which is next. That's the next episode.
Yeah, there you go.
Go on, wipe out
next.
That would be good. But the thing that kind of puzzles me the most, because I agree with you 100% on all of that, but it's like, what possesses people to believe this about this airport? There's so many conspiracy theories surrounding it. There's so much intrigue. And really, what drove Denver International Airport wasn't something as nefarious as the New World Order or alien infrastructure, but that state's need to drive commerce and infrastructure to actually help their state survive. So it's capitalism, which, again, you know, we have debated in our past episodes about how evil and nefarious that is. However, it doesn't really answer why people need to believe in conspiracy theories either. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about sort of these ambitious plans that Colorado had for this airport and how those aspirations actually became cautionary tale, but it's almost as weird as any of the conspiracy theories out there.
I'm super excited. So airports themselves are pretty weird, but why are we talking about this particular airport? So for those that haven't heard of this conspiracy theory ever before, I think my favorite thing on the conspiracies is actually from flydenver.com itself. So it's from the airport. It's was released on the Denver International Airport 25th anniversary, I guess. And so it's just a PDF handout that says conspiracies. And so it says, you may or may not have heard, Den's got some secrets. Since the airport opened in 95, endless rumors and theories swirl around Denver International Airport. People say our underground tunnels lead to secret meeting facilities for the world's elite. Our blue horse is thought to be cursed. Some believe we're connected to the New World Order and the Freemasons. Some even say we're home to a colony of lizard people. Here's the full scoop on Den's wildest rumors. And then it just goes through again. It's a one pager. And so these are the things. It says the New World Order built the airport, and then it gives conspiracy and then reality. Mustang, a beautiful statue, is cursed. Den has extraterrestrial map coordinates. The gargoyles are sinister. There's secret messages inscribed in the floor. And Den is very connected, and not just to airline destinations, which says that it's connected to Cheyenne Mountain and NORAD. So it makes a giant survival bunker for the, what's the word? For the end of the world. Can you imagine having to put out, like, you just work at this airport, and you've never heard of these conspiracies before, maybe you start working there, like, listen,
don't. Can you imagine? Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and this was something that, like, again, that there is actually a lot of information on. And there is this letter communication between the head of PR, or I think one of the heads of PR at the time, and these conspiracy people that are demanding answers from them. And it's pretty hysterical, because at a certain point, like, again, like you were saying, so you come to work, you know, and you're working in PR and marketing for this major municipality, and it's a great opportunity, and they've just launched this new airport, and there's this huge art project and cultural project, and it's going to be really exciting. And then you have people demanding answers on the lizard people from you. So it's like, I think at a certain point, you know, you almost push past being just tired of answering it to where it almost becomes like hysteria. Like, it becomes really funny.
It's a real life Parks and Recreation episode.
It really truly has that flavor to it. Like, if it Ron Swanson was being like, yes, let me tell you about the lizard people, you know, like, that is exactly what they've had to deal with. And they still have to deal with it. And I will say that the one thing that feels like it disables, and we'll go into this with conspiracy, but the one thing that feels like it disables the ability for conspiracy to grow is sort of co-opting it and making it funny. So when they were doing the most recent construction, all of their construction banners were like, are we building a special executive lounge for the lizard people? Wait and find out. You know, it's sort of like they totally took away any of the, I don't know, like, any of the sting or any of the nefariousness, subterfuge, and are like, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing.
I was going to say, conspiracy breeds in secrecy. right? It's where people find conspiracy. So if they're just like, this is a Cinnabon idiot, it's not a lizard people breeding station.
Or maybe it is, and they love Cinnabon.
I don't know. Like, you know, are these anti-Annie pretzels or are these gray alien eggs? You know, it really takes away the sting. But the thing is that it's history and everything else. Like, if you look at it historically, all of the crazy crap people point to for these conspiracy theories kind of makes sense. So let's dig into the history first. So, all right, to start off with, how did this airport start? Give me a little bit of background here, Marie.
So when construction started on Denver International, the airport really was in the middle of nowhere. It's in Adams County. And when it started, there was absolutely no other buildings, no homes, nothing around it. It was just flat plains. And the old airport that it inevitably took the place of was actually really centrally located to Denver, only 3 miles from downtown. And Stapleton, the old airport, had actually been there since 1929. So everything was fine. People were using Stapleton. You could fly out of it from downtown until the event of airline deregulation. And I know at this point, we've probably lost the majority of our listeners. And they're like, oh, sweet, maybe next they'll talk about taxes. But this is important because it really does, it shows one of the major changes that kind of helped foster these conspiracy theories. So prior to 1978, the federal government regulated airlines, and anything an airline had to do had to go through regulation. So they had to seek approval for control over fares. They had to seek approval for routes. Even if you wanted to start a new airline, you had to go through the government for that. Now, when this one's listed, the commercial boom just hit, and it was a free market. So all of a sudden, a company could come in and a new company could come into the market and introduce really, really low fares or increase the number of flights. So now more Americans could fly more often for a lot less money. But like with anything, the boom had a huge trade-off. It meant more competition overall for all of the airlines. So
less, like, again, if people are competing to be the cheapest airline, you can imagine you probably want, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm old, call me old fashioned, Marie, but if I'm on an airplane, I want it to be like safe and well manned and have, I don't know, at least whatever, a little bit of controls as I'm speeding through the air at, you know what I mean, hundreds of miles per hour.
That's a good point. And not to get too wonky or too political, but regulation does come with a certain amount of, well, regulation, right? Like, hey, we have to make sure that these things are fixed. Hey, we have to make sure that these fares make sense. But again, like, as you know, when this was lifted, all of a sudden old airports had to accommodate, and there was all this new complexity. Like, oh my God, we have to keep up with these new airlines. They've got more gate space. We need more counter space. We need to ramp up at like key airports, of which there were only a few. So if you can imagine, it's, for a lack of a prettier analogy, it's shoving 10 pounds of shit into a 5 pound bag.
Put shit into a bag.
I know. It's, you know what? I've been hanging out with my dad more, and
that's an Old West thing, Marie. I don't know. That's an Old West thing. Spending too much time out there in the prairie.
It's like your supply chain. All of a sudden, you've hit the bottleneck, right? Like, you've got all of these other people that are like, hey, we can do it cheaper, faster, and better, and we can fly you to Tampa for $7. Hell, we'll get you drunk and fly you to Tampa. How about that? And everyone's like, ooh, that sounds good.
Slap you to this catapult and shoot you out there to Miami, idiot. Yeah.
That's exactly what we're going
to
do.
Okay, so deregulation leads to this huge boom in demand for airport space, routes, everything, for everything having to do with airline travel.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And at that point, there just weren't enough airports to go around. Mm. So this shortage led to airports creating, kind of taking over a single airport and using it as their hub. And it really is sort of the same way that we fly today. So an airport would come in and sort of dominate a airport with as many flights, as many gates, and as many options as humanly possible to get travel in and out of. So if you think about it like it's a hub, and maybe you're flying in from Seattle and you need to have a connecting flight to, say, New York. So you really want that hub to be somewhere in the middle of the United States so you're able to get as many flights in and out as humanly possible.
Which is interesting, though, because I think about stuff like, so Delta is the airline that I fly all the time because it's the one that my work gives me a discount for and I get lots of miles and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So for Delta, though, their hubs are out of, like, I think it's Atlanta, maybe Chicago is one, too. Chicago is, like, everyone's hub. Mm-hmm. I think Chicago is, like, United or American Airlines. But this hub and spoke strategy is really super-duper common. So basically, it's, you know, you go to an airport. It is basically, there's one airport where all your flights end up going out of. So if you fly anywhere on the East Coast of the United States from anywhere else, you almost always end up getting routed to Denver International Airport because it is a hub city. Denver. I'm an idiot. To Denver, maybe. But also, mm-hmm. like, you will get routed to Atlanta if you're going to the East Coast.
Exactly. So and you try right. and have as many strategic hubs as possible, right, to get the most maximum amount of flights in and out. So, but at the time when this whole deregulation thing happened, there weren't airports. There weren't those massive hubs. And if there was an existing airport, it kind of got snapped up quickly. So all of a sudden, you know, the middle of the country sees this huge opportunity to become one of these hubs and to build an airport. So then the race is on, like, how do we build an airport and what's the best state to build an airport in? And really, when you look at the middle of the country, the states that it's optimal for were Utah, Kansas, and Colorado.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Big deal. That's interesting. So, and also the states that, again, states that had, at that time at least, still today, to this day, I'd say in some of these cases, fairly poor infrastructure development. We're not talking about places like, you know, again, and by infrastructure development, I'm not crapping on your roads and bridges, Kansas. But, you know, what I mean is, like, if, you know, the number of major cities or major centers of population with lots of connecting roads for travel and rail connections and then everything else to go to the airport in these areas at the time was pretty, pretty rough. And there wasn't a lot right. to it. And even in some right. parts of, you know,
space.
Right. And even today in some parts of Utah, Kansas, or Colorado, right in the middle of the country, the amount of infrastructure we've put in to help make those areas more, you know, more
traversable,
I guess, is what I'd say. You know, there hasn't been a whole lot of it. So Denver, post-regulation Denver, it ended up becoming the sixth busiest airport in the United States. And most of that comes from connecting yeah. flyers.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the old airport. So that was Stapleton. That was the one that was only, you know, just a stone's throw from downtown.
Right. So you have these different parts of the country now fighting to become those hub areas, right? Because it's going to bring in lots of tax revenue. It's going to bring in lots of money. It's going to bring in lots of business. It's all good, you'd think. So Denver, though, after the regulation, the Stapleton Airport climbed to be the sixth busiest airport in the United States. And most of that comes from connecting flyers. So basically, most of the airport traffic, at least half of it at that time, actually, was just passing through. So these are people, again, you fly in, you get a slice of, I was going to say a slice of pizza, but in Colorado, I'd imagine you're probably getting something like maybe a slice of pie or something. But, you know, you're passing through. You're not staying in the mm-hmm. area for a long time. The old airport there, Stapleton, was reliable, functional. Basically, there's nothing wrong with it. But the state representatives in Colorado realized this deregulation really represented an opportunity for them. And again, not just opportunity, right? But money, real serious money. And the person who saw this potential most clearly than others was Federico Pena, Denver's mayor elected to office in 1983. Pena's first term, a year into it, Colorado fell into a major recession. So the unemployment rate was 2 points above the national average. There was a 30% vacancy rate in downtown Denver in terms of office space, and every sector of the economy imploded. Basically, the city's economy had gone bust with the oil industry, which was a big part of the economy. And they thought, well, okay, if the oil industry isn't going to be doing it, we'll do it with air travel. Although, frankly, substituting something that was once based on oil for something that instead is based on gasoline seems pretty dumb. But, oh my goodness, yeah, I'm not a mayor. I don't know. I'm
wrong. It's the 80s.
It's the 80s. That's true. Everyone's hopped up on cocaine. So Pena persuaded local politicians that they needed to act. He said, we had to invest. We had Republicans, Democrats, and independents coming together to get the airport approved, financed, and built. And that was a quote from Pena. And actually, other cities started to kind of bite at the bit a little bit here, too. So Salt Lake City's mayor, Palmer DePaulis, said the long-haul flyers could make connections at his city's airport instead if Denver could not take the lead. He said, quote, we'd like to fill that gap if Denver doesn't take the lead and build a new airport.
Yeah, so you can see sort of the gold rush to build a new airport and to get all of this revenue for your state is on. And the leaders, Colorado leaders and Colorado government are definitely starting to feel the pressure of, you know, we've got to somehow build this new airport and get this money and get this travel and kind of situate ourselves as the hub for whatever airline. However, they had a really pretty good number six airport in the United States, right? They had Stapleton. So how do you go about, you can't have two airports. So you have to kind of have a blood sacrifice, if you will, since we're talking conspiracy, and sacrifice one of the airports to build the new one. And so they had to start situating and communicating out that Stapleton wasn't just old. It wasn't just an old airport around since 1929. It's completely antiquated. And so they started to socialize messaging around, well, it has, you know, all but one airport that has to be shut down in snow and bad weather. The only way that we could expand is onto potentially poisonous, toxic Rocky Flats arsenal, which, again, excellent. You know, if you want a scare tactic for your voting public, you know, I think saying, you know, going into a toxic, the only way we can do this is to release toxic gas into our children's lungs is a pretty good, that's a pretty good selling point.
And this place only has one Cinnabon. You mean to tell me an airport with one Cinnabon is modern, is going to operate now? There's no way.
I mean, come on, people, come on. And it was just too close to the densely populated downtown. And there was just too many noise complaints, right? If we try and put in more planes, it's just going to make more noise. Now, bear in mind,
you know what stops noise complaints, Marie? Buttload of new construction.
You know, I can't help but think that you're right, Chris. As long as it's out, but again, like, remember the place, you know, and this is they're you know, while they're digging the grave for Stapleton, they're shopping around for, you know, where are we going to put our new trophy airport? And they're like, oh, way out in the hills and far away from everyone in Adams County. But I mean, bear in mind, Stapleton was lucrative. It was making a profit of $50 million to $80 million a year.
Oh my God.
But, you know, which is not bad. Again, for something I think if you look at it situationally, and I know that this is, again, getting a little wonky, but that's a good amount of money for something that is not broke, don't fix it kind of thing, right? Like $80 million a year is not bad. But you know what? They took it to the vote. They got it. They got the chance to take it to the vote. And because of their efforts, because of, again, sort of their lobbying of the people of Colorado, it was approved by 65% of Denver voters in 1989. And it's easy to say that 65% is a pretty good margin to get something to pass. Like, you're not going to have a lot of people agree on a lot of things.
No, 65% is amazing. I mean, I guess it was 1989. That's crazy. Yeah. 65%. I guess the 90s are a little bit more peaceful, but oh my God. All right. We're going to dig right back into this after our break.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They're able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.
Denver International Airport, so first off, we have all of this, again, conspiracy breeds in secrecy.
Right.
And it also breeds in places where it looks like stuff doesn't make sense. Like, you know, you have this great airport that was fine and making loads of money, and now you're making another one, and people don't want to just take the explanation that, like, well, yeah, government loves to, spend money and be corrupt and everything else. Mm-hmm. People need it to make sense. There has to be something besides just basic human evil and greed to explain this. Now, Denver International Airport becomes a huge project. So,
yes,
it goes on to become 7 times larger than the size of the original Stapleton Airport. That makes it twice the size of Manhattan,
which is crazy
for a place that most people are just going through.
Exactly.
They're like, they're coming in and they're just leaving.
Yes. Yes. And this is the whole municipality. Like, this is the whole, this isn't just the airport itself, but it is the airport, the square footage of the actual, what it takes to run the airport. Yes.
Yeah. It becomes the second largest public works project in the entire world. It's second only to the Channel, which links England and France. And by land area, it becomes the largest U.S. airport and the third largest in the world. So
third largest in the world, which isn't, that's nuts.
Again, for an airport that was already kind of working okay, it, you know, they expanded. They really expanded. It ends up to, interestingly enough, in the construction, they move 110 million cubic yards of earth. That is 1/3 of the amount of earth that was moved to build the Panama Canal.
Yeah. And I think, again, you're just kind of getting, you know, they refer to it as epic. This was an epic scope and an epic everything. And I think that really, when you start to dig into those details, you realize it was nothing short of that.
They thought really that this was going to be the engine for their economy. They thought this was what, yeah, this is what the future, yeah, of Denver and the state of Colorado really was going to be based on. So,
yeah, we were talking about sort of the evils of and greed, but it was, I do think, you know, to to kind of, I don't want to soften, you know, soften our stance on capitalism too much, but to say that, like, this did represent opportunity, legit opportunity.
Oh, absolutely.
For Colorado and for Colorado infrastructure and for supporting Colorado infrastructure, which, you know, I think we can all agree is a necessity.
Absolutely.
To the scope that they decided to take it and sort of the bells and whistles that they decided to go with, that's debatable.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of an overestimation. So
maybe.
Denver, the city of Denver hires architect August Perez of New Orleans, who's a personal friend of the mayor's. And so the idea here behind the architecture was this to be a 19th century style train station with huge riveted beams, massive skylights, and just to look really like, if you're envisioning in your head sort of, you know, what is, again, what is like the train station that an oil baron gets, mm-hmm, off his private car at? This is what they want you to think of, you know?
Which I think is a very perfect take on it. And again, not highly practical.
No.
Right? Because you're like, okay, huge riveted beam, massive skylights.
Okay. No, God, yeah, it's, again, a little bit of extra, mm-hmm, stuff here. And so they end, mm-hmm, up, so that's the architect. They end up getting the firm Fentress Bradburn to be the real production architect for the project. So the way this works is basically you have the architect who designs things and then the production firm who actually goes on and has to build the damn thing. Mm-hmm. And so they have to, like, take that design. They have to make the blueprints. They have to oversee the construction. They're really the ones that get it done. And they're also, unfortunately for them, the people who have to decide if this can be done on budget and on time.
Yeah, again, it's the 10 pounds of shit into the 5-pound bag analogy.
Exactly. And so what this construction firm decided was, we're trying to eat way too much shit here. Can't do it, right? So the train station example, or the idea behind the train station thing, it overshot budget by $54 million. Marie, do you know how many little pumps that is?
I can only imagine that it's a handful. It's a handful of little pumps.
It's like 18 little pumps. Crazy. Oh my,
it's almost two handfuls.
So,
but that's a lot of money to be over budget immediately.
It's a like crazy, they haven't even done anything else.
They haven't broken ground. That's a lot of money.
Crazy amounts to be over budget. They end up. So again, well, here's the thing, though, right? This architect himself cost the city a huge amount of money.
Yes.
So yes. If you think about it,
even though
he was
a friend of the mayor's, like, I'm sure exactly. He even got the friend of mayor's, you know, discount.
Yeah. So, all right. Before anything is even built, this airport project is already looking like it's probably not going to happen exactly the way they thought. So the city ended up having to buy out Perez, the architect, for $6 million. And the construction architecture firm was asked to basically, okay, well, listen, you redesign it then if that's not what's going to happen. And so
it's a total drop back and punt.
Yeah. They're like, all right, so we can't make this night, you know, I don't even know how to describe it.
It's not going to be the Robber Barons train station. So, wow, what you got? Yeah. You know, what kind of doodles can you come up with that are going to like get us back on schedule? Because too, at this point, time's wasting.
Yeah, to be fair. Right. So this other company did end up making something really cool. So they built, they basically decided on the design. They thought they wanted it to be something like an encampment of Native Americans on a bluff. So the architecture wanted to acknowledge the original inhabitants of the area and be sympathetic to the regional environment. This is a quote actually from the main architect. But the basic idea here was they wanted to create a central terminal. Now it's known as the Jepensen or the Jepessen terminal. And they wanted that to be a kind of the center point of this sort of community of other terminals that would come together. And again, from far away, they wanted you to be thinking of or looking at it as a kind of a, again, what you see in your mind's eye when you think about you're a cowboy going along the range and there is a encampment of Native Americans, right? The original inhabitants of the land.
Bear in mind, this is the 1990s. We haven't really begun to socialize the idea of reappropriation.
Right. And Right.
Yeah.
We understand this is not exactly the most acceptable viewpoint today. And I'm sure the Native Americans who the land was taken from to build this were very, very thrilled that they wanted to make it look like a teepee. So
I know.
Interestingly enough, the terminal itself, they use fabric on it. It's woven fiberglass that's coated then in Teflon. So that's to make it waterproof and everything else. So the design overall was in budget and it was on time. And so it was immediately received the stamp of approval from the mayor. However, they decided, all right, maybe comparing it to the teepees of Native Americans is a little bit offensive. So instead, we're going to say it's built to represent the mountain peaks of the Rockies. Issue with that is they already had all these interviews where they said it was the teepees. So that doesn't really work.
Again, I think that is one of the beautiful things about this story is like the restructuring of the narrative, right? Like, oh, Stapleton's antiquated. It's a dinosaur. No. These are the Rocky Mountains. This is the Front Range you're looking at. We would never do something so offensive.
Except we would. So,
but look over here, bright and shiny. Right. Yeah.
Don't look at the man behind the teepee. So, so everything was approved. Right, we're all good to go. It starts being constructed in September of 1989. Initially, the cost estimates are around $2.08 billion. That's the original estimate. But again, ultimately, we can look back at history and say, well, the airport, though, didn't board its first passenger until February of 95. So it had four major delays. It took 6 years to build. And ultimately, the real construction cost was about $3 billion. So about $1 billion over original estimate. Which, if you think back to when we said that they didn't want to go for something that was going to be $54 million over budget, or $54 million over budget, I should say, pretty funny that it ended up costing them $3 billion or $1 billion more.
$1 billion. That seems like, again, my naivete might be showing, but this seems like a lot.
It fits a little bit, a lot. Well, so what ended up happening was they just took crazy decisions. They just chose to do stuff that, again, like, and this is where the conspiracy comes in, is it's like, we're going to build a giant, like, looks like a fire-breathing demon horse statue at the entrance. Like, why? You're already $1 billion over budget. Why are you choosing to do that, dude?
We're going to get into, like, why they went with the weird art as well. And I think that it is, I think the point that you hit on is really, again, like, this need to, you know, the government's need, the leadership's need to kind of drive infrastructure, commerce, is well-meaning, but then sort of hubris brings it in $1 million and 6 years later. So, I mean, you have all of this time to have conspiracies just fester about it, right? Like, that's a long time to be waiting for something. And I think as soon as you start to add in some of the other stuff, like the weird art, that can really begin to add to the whole conspiracy. So we're getting into the weird art. And really, the thing to remember is, like, Denver International Airport was the first airport in America to feature art, to really feature art and to make it a big deal. And so that's a big deal. Like, that was happening, again, when they put it in place and started to put it into construction in the early 90s. But in 1988, Peña made an executive order that directed 1% of any capital improvement project over $1 million undertaken by the city to set aside an inclusion for art. Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, is not a terrible. I actually kind of support that. I think that's kind of a cool idea.
I think it's a very important idea because it's saying, hey, if you're coming in and you're building this huge capital, you know, this ginormous cement building, you also need to do something to appreciate the arts. And any 1% of that capital improvement has to go towards that. And that became the public arts program. And it was law. And to kind of understand and consider, like, what does that art look like? How do we define it that we're making people spend money on? He established what he called a blue ribbon committee to consider public art as well as architecture, sort of the aesthetics and the design, especially for the airport. So they had a budget. They started off with a budget of exceeding $7 million. And the program there at the airport grew into the single largest facility art program in the nation.
Damn.
So again, I know at the time, this is a massive deal. Like, this airport is, you know, not only is it going to be being built, but it's going to be built with $7 million worth of art, which, again, when you think about an airport now, that's a lot more common. I think that that's something that other airports, both internationally and in the United States, have adapted more. But really, at the time, that was insane. But it was also very welcomed. So his blue ribbon committee oversaw the commission of all of his artwork, and they had one uniting theme for what they had to look for and kind of how to qualify the art, and they called it journey, right? So it's the idea of journey, which is very, very fitting, right, for an airport.
Yeah, but still pretty nebulous. It's like, I want to make my theme called Vision.
Well, I see.
What does that mean?
I'll tell you what. If you can gather up $7 million, you're going to have people coming to you with like, let me tell you about my installation for Vision.
Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah, I get it. But it's just a weird. Like, I get it. It's an airport journey. Sure. Yeah. Okay. It's fine. On the nose a little bit.
It's
whatever.
Also, it's you know, yes, and you can argue, you know, as a humanities major, I could argue, well, it's also the journey of the history of Colorado. It could be the journey of the people that, you know, our ancestry, yada, yada, yada. So the committee, these group of people had to be conscientious to consider all of the cultural components for the art pieces given, right? So they couldn't really be overtly offensive or too obscene, quote unquote, or anything like that. It had to be appropriate. And they really, this group of people were local business leaders and artists, and probably the most well-known of them was a man by the name of Charles Ansbacher. So Charles Ansbacher himself is a fascinating, fascinating character. He was born in Providence, 1942, and he loved music. And this love of music was encouraged early on by his parents, who were both noted alderman psychologists, Dr. Heinz Ludwig and Rowena Ansbacher. So he had shrinks for parents, and he loved music. But the interesting thing about alderman psychology is it focuses on the identity of identifying the origin of a patient's feeling of inferiority and how they sense and how this sense of this inferiority can lead to rejecting reality as common sense.
So a total healthy family dynamic.
Well, yes. So, I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, like, it's hard to imagine, like, when we think about our parents, it's hard enough. But his parents were grounded in diagnosing what could also be described as a conspiratorial mindset.
Right. What they're talking about is kind of the common, you know, skeptical argument, or kind of the, I would say, a straw man generally of, you know, well, people believe in conspiracy theories because they feel inferior about themselves or they need something to believe in or whatever.
And I'm going to reject reality that's good for me and kind of common sense for something that is false. And so how do you go about kind of regrounding someone?
Sure.
And, you know, and bringing them back to something that makes more sense.
Right.
So Heinz Ansbacher, his father, served in World War II, and he served with the Allied Psychological Warfare Division. So if you want to talk about like a lot of the conspiracy theories that we'll get into that later kind of swirl around Charles Ansbacher, his son, I mean, you hear the Psychological Warfare Division and you immediately are like, huh, that's interesting. But he actually had a very interesting role in that he was responsible for writing the pamphlets that were dropped in war zones to try and persuade German soldiers to defect or surrender.
Hmm.
Yeah, so this led to him writing a book in 1948 on the attitudes of German prisoners of war, a study of the dynamics of National Socialism fellowship. And the study was basically, you know, it was covering the time that he obtained questionnaires administered to these German prisoners of war who had been in captivity for anywhere from like 2 days, 4 days to 2 weeks. And these questions were designed for various purposes. Like some of them were to try and get estimates of the troop movement, the troop morale, you know, to clarify problems around the propaganda, and to appraise the effectiveness of how effective were these combat leaflets and other propaganda material. But his real responsibility was to try and break the German soldiers from National Socialism.
So kind of an early decult or cult deprogrammer.
Yes.
In some
which
ways.
Is fascinating.
Yeah,
which
really,
is fascinating.
Really interesting.
And it's like, again, like National Socialism, dogmatic, persuasive, you know, and his job was not to just get them to defect, but to understand how they were, to get to like, how did they convince themselves of their beliefs in the first place? And then the biggest thing from my research that he was really trying to understand was to get them to teach them empathy, right? To teach them empathy for other people. So like his parents, Charles was dedicated to unifying people in his own way through a shared love of music. He went on to become the Colorado Springs Symphony Director. He worked tirelessly to, you know, to advocate and push budget issues for the local arts. He took the Colorado Springs Orchestra from a part-time group with some piddly budget to a year-round professional orchestra with a budget of $2 million.
Dang.
So, I mean, again, he, you know, and I, going into my, again, I would encourage our listeners to kind of, whenever they hear outside of our podcast, whenever they hear sort of these conspiracy rumors around this, to research what this man did with his life, because it is really remarkable. And don't get a chance to go into all of it here, but it's truly moving and very remarkable. He went, just as a quick side note, he went to war-torn countries to help them with their music. So he went to Sarajevo and conducted the Sarajevo Orchestra. Even when they didn't have electricity, even when they were like in war-torn places, he would go in and try and bring people together through their love of music.
A pretty inspiring person and a pretty really interesting parental research. That's kind of crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know, we talk about, again, but this is where now the links, the web of conspiracy starts to grow, right? You mean to tell me that this guy with this specific kind of mental control over people worldview,
whose
parents helped the government stop the Germans, who again are kind of especially in conspiracy theory, there's always a bit of a tinge of like not pro-Nazi necessarily, but pro-right wing. Yeah. There's a view that, yes, you know, government itself, like
distrust of the arts.
Right. It's not even just distrust of the arts, because it's not really pro-fascism. It's anti-socialism.
Yes.
And socialism, I think for a lot of people, tends to have a connotation of like controlling the thoughts of other people, right? Stamping out the bad thoughts, you know, having good thoughts, having good thinking, group thinking, whatever. That's what this guy's dad worked on. Super interesting. And
I think that, yeah, like I said, he's totally worth looking into and talking to more. But this is the individual that Pena sort of entrusted with DIA and would head the group that would oversee the art that was going to be purchased and commissioned for the airport.
I'm starting to think there's a damn conspiracy theory here, Marie. You haven't convinced me at all. All right, so let's talk about some of the art.
Gotten thing. To the chemtrails. So let's get to the art itself, which again, just in thinking about art, like again, even though the main mission of this commission that is looking to find the art is not to do anything incredibly offensive or incredibly controversial, it's subjective. All art is subjective. So no matter what's going to happen, you're going to offend a group of people with your ideas. But this one in particular, I can kind of see where the conspiracy theory is going with it. So just outside of the main entrance to Denver Airport, in the median of Pena Boulevard, stands the first piece especially commissioned for the airport. It's called Blue Mustang. And it was done by artist Luis Jimenez. Now, Blue Mustang is 32 feet tall, and he is exactly that. It's an electric blue horse reared up on its hind legs with glowing neon red eyes. Now, there is absolutely nothing around this statue, right? There's nothing even close. So the size and proximity, it's difficult to do it justice because it's truly terrifying. It's like basically you come out of nowhere and there is this ginormous blue horse with glowing red eyes.
There is something so funny to me about this group of like erudite artists in a room together deciding on what art to add on their blue ribbon panel and having someone stand up and be like, let's make a big ass horse. And then we're all just being like, agreed. Yes, oh, I see what he means there. Yes, the horse represents so much to me. Jimenez, just a big-ass horse.
Well, yes, but Jimenez wanted Blue Mustang to pay tribute to the country's historic relationship with the horse.
Okay, but it's like...
It's a big thing in Colorado.
All right, but it's and like it's like the Old West equivalent. It's like the Old West. It's like if in Staten Island they decided to make a big statue of, like, you know... Of a naked vampire woman. Like, it's like, it's like, oh, okay.
Is that what Staten Island is?
No, I'm sorry. It's like the, it's just such a.
I would go to see that.
It's such a, it's like, you know, with tattoos, like, it's just, it's such bad. I feel like a giant horse statue is such stupid bad taste.
To be fair, remember, the commission of it doesn't necessarily mean that they have an entire. Like they have control over it, right? They're bringing these artists on. The Jimenez especially gave some description to it, and the original position of Blue Mustang was different than where it was now. It was moved. So originally it was going to frame downtown Denver, Pikes Peak in the mountains, and it would have been accessible to people. So it would have been sort of more in proximity to other buildings, and people would be able to approach it and to look at it, you know, if they chose to. Not that that necessarily diminishes the terrifying nature, but it sort of puts it, it gives it a better or maybe more relatable context. But because of the airport layout, they decided that they had to move it. So they were like, okay, let's just put it here. So yeah, so it's terrifying, but it also signified a huge accomplishment for Jimenez, who was an artist that was now creating like one of the first pieces at this new airport with this new mentality, and it was going to leave his mark in the art world. So as an artist, you know, who's selling his art, who's trying to become more well-known and who's trying to establish himself, this was a huge opportunity. But it also is a huge responsibility. And he said in subsequent interviews that such a tremendous condition, you know, was really taxing. And he was a man who was getting up there in age. To be honest, he was older, and he was also even blind in his left eye. But again, like, this is a huge opportunity. He's sort of, you know, now committed to it. But he started to miss the timelines for completion. So the city of Denver ultimately filed a lawsuit against him for the $165,000 that they had paid up front. But they said, hey, we'll drop that lawsuit if the sculpture would be finished by the end of the year. But he still didn't get it completed. So again, here's this old man. He's blind in one eye. He's seeing his legacy as an artist, you know, coming to a close with his age. He has this opportunity to make his work legendary and to outlive him which is sort of the inspiration of, you know, of artists. I want to create something that's going to be for future generations. So, but then 2006, while completing Mustang, an unsecured piece of the 9,000-pound sculpture fell on him, killing him. So this is where you can kind of understand where the conspiracy took place. Like, well, this is fodder. This is excellent fodder for conspiracy people. So Jimenez was by himself in the studio rushing to finish. It was nearly completed. He was using a rope to hoist a section of the sculpture into place so it could be welded, because again, all metal. The hoist broke. The piece fell on the 66-year-old, pinning him to the ground, slicing an artery in his leg, and he died on his studio floor.
Oh my God!
Right.
That's crazy.
So 2007, the almost finished Mustang finally completed and installed. It now has a value that has doubled and then tripled to close to $2 million. So Blue Mustang was installed 2 years later after Jimenez's death. The city ended up paying $650,000, more than double what they originally intended. But many in the art community praised the statue as a crowning achievement, and it being sort of the pinnacle of his work since he had died completing it. And Michael Hancock, the then president of the Denver City Council, quite aptly prophesized, it will forever incite dialogue. And oh yeah, oh it has, my friends. Blue Mustang immediately took some backlash. People say it looked, and I quote, apocalyptic, devilish. Coupled with the untimely death of the artist, Blue Mustang took on the identified cursed object. And he was given the moniker of Blucifer, which is actually one of my favorite, you know, nicknames.
It's pretty cool. If you're going to have a cursed
object, Blucifer is nice. That's pretty good. So detractors said it, you know, it's possessed. It's horrible. It's disturbing. Demon horse, blue stallion of death. In 2008, letters to the Rocky Mountain News said, and I quote, it looks like it wants to trample you, destroy you. A statue of a giant male horse, electric eyed, cobalt blue, and anatomically correct was installed on February 2008. And it's freaking out more than a few people. And then they had even some haikus come in, which is my favorite. Spooky blue flame steed greets us with heinous anus. This is art? Horseshit.
It is. I mean, okay, when they say it's anatomically correct, they mean it. It is, you see the full butthole. You see his fruit and veg. It's all there for everybody to see. It's pretty hilarious. One of the things that I think is sort of, if you look at any of Jimenez's other art, that's just kind of his style, is doing stuff that like looks like it came out of straight out of hell. Like yes. He's got one of his that I really like is called Man on Fire. It's literally a guy like aflame. He's done a similar other outdoor art. It's always of giant weird blue animals. He's got one called Los Lagartos, which is the alligators, which is this like, it's just like four alligators like chomping and whatever. He's done, all of his horses look like Lucifer. They're these like blue veiny terrifying things. It's just weird. I like it, but it's weird. Like if you haven't seen it, nothing we say to you, listener, if you haven't seen it before, nothing we say to you will give you the right impression. This horse, it is blue. It is like veiny. It looks almost skeletal. Like it's a horse from a nightmare. It really is. I don't understand why they thought this was a good idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, and something that's controversial immediately. So did they tear it down?
So, all right. So in early 2009, a local developer in the area, Rachel Hulton, actually made a Facebook page called DIA's Heinous Blue Mustang Has Got to Go. It got thousands of members very quickly, got a front page story in the Wall Street Journal, another major piece in the New York Times. It was all over the place. It's now defunct, though. And ultimately, the DIA, so the Denver International Airport, conducted a public art survey in 2011 to talk for the next round of art acquisitions. And so from those results, artist Matt Shesansky said that he didn't have many calls today to remove the piece. There's discussion going on. And so 50% of people seem to love it. 50% seem to hate it. But the survey found that the Mustang is the best known piece of art at DIA. It's become really a cultural touch point and a national one at that. So because of that, they're not going to, I don't think they're ever going to get rid of it. You know, so Patty Ortiz, who is the one of the people working there, says, quote, I've always loved this work. And I think a lot of times it can be misunderstood because it's kind of fierce in a way and not easy to look at. But it's not meant to be easy. It's supposed to challenge and make them think, end quote. What I like about that with art is, and we can get into this maybe on an episode about art. What I like about it is, if someone doesn't like something, you can just say, well, it's not supposed to be liked. It's supposed to be challenging. Which I think is hilarious. So it's not going down. It's never going down. In the span of 5 short years, the statue has gone from absolutely cursed to absolutely beloved. It's become a symbol of Denver. It's become thought, you know, it's thought to be like this badass symbol of the area, and people really like it, you know. So this is one from Chandler Romeo, an artist who's on the current committee, says, I love the Mustang. And the reason I love it is because it doesn't matter who you're talking to, where you are, people will react. Everyone will talk about the Mustang. To my mind, that's fantastic. Either they hate it or love it, but it evokes a response. And that really, I think, is probably the value. You know, if art is supposed to do anything, it is supposed to get people up in arms. It's supposed to make you think or act or feel something. And even if the thing you feel is absolute loathing and fear, I guess that's a good thing. So, all right, the giant, you know, horse with the butt and the fruit and veg and everything else. That's one other thing. There's also other works of art displayed at the terminal. So one of them is what's been known on the internet now is just the mural. But the mural is actually known as Children of the World Dream of Peace, and it's by Leo Tanguma. The mural measures 11 by 25 feet. And interestingly enough, so if you look at any of the work by Tanguma, all of his works sort of show the struggle for dignity, justice, self-determination, and human rights. Now, this mural is pretty intense. And so the way that the airport describes it is it's showing the artist's desire to abolish violence in society. So again, the mural is supposed to show here kind of war and then peace, right? So peace winning over war. But in the sections that depict war, kind of intense. So the first two panels show an armed military figure in a gas mask wearing like this spooky hat, looks like a, you know, like a stormtrooper with a gun, with a sword. You know, there's women crying and children sleeping, look like they're dead and everything else. It's pretty crazy. So the figure itself has been described as looking like a World War II Nazi officer. And I got to say, yeah, pretty on point there. It's definitely what it looks like. And again, it just shows like ruined buildings, dead or dying children, mothers grieving with dead infants still in their arms. It's super intense for like trying to find an airport bathroom. The then next panel shows the soldier vanquished at the bottom, with children joyously standing over him, dressed in all of their national costumes, holding swords wrapped in their nation's flags over their shoulders. And so the swords are then basically like turning around this rainbow above the kids' heads. So it's a very, very interesting, like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's, even that part is pretty
difficult.
It's pretty weird. It's like, it's
difficult to look at, right?
Yeah,
and I think
go ahead.
It's difficult. It's difficult to look at, sort of like Lucifer. And I think, again, situationally, if you were at a gallery or at a museum and you saw this, you would have a much different reaction than if you were on your way to baggage claim.
Right. Yes.
So contextually, this art is having a different effect on you just because of where you are, not because it's because of its content. I mean, again, like its content is, I think, is really kind of aggressive. But like I was saying, if you were somewhere else, that might not come across the way it does at an airport.
It's really interesting. And I mean, I think it's definitely worth, if you haven't ever seen it, listeners, it's definitely worth taking a look at, because it is sort of an interesting piece of art. I would say it's an interesting mural and everything else, but it's super duper trippy. Like, again, it's showing like, yeah, it's just very, very weird. It's very, very strange. And so
it's big. That's the other thing about a lot of this art.
Yeah, it's also huge. So in an article actually published about the creation of the piece, it says that when he was making it, a van full of conspiracy theorists pull up to his house and demanded answers. The artist said that they weren't really hostile, but they asked him loads of questions, and he tried to talk about what the mural was supposed to be meaning, right? So the first part is about the environment and the ways that humans destroy nature and themselves through genocide. The second part is about humanity coming together to rehab nature and to revive their own compassion. It's interesting, but he goes on to say that conspiracy theorists interpret his works in the most naive way. But I think that that's kind of a him problem and not a viewer problem, right? Like, again, if you're making art and people are like, holy shit, this feels really gross and evil, and you're like, no, 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 you just don't get it, that seems like a you problem, right?
Well, again, I would argue that it is subjective. And if you decide as a conspiracy theorist to look at it and read it in one way, and someone else looks at it and views it in a different way, then that's the nature of art. So the artist, Taguma, can say that, yeah, that is the most naive way. That's not my intent. That's still what they interpret, but that's not my intent. So with any of these things, it's like, well, I am bringing my own subjective knowledge and experience to this painting, and that's, or to this mural, to this giant blue horse, and how I interpret it and how I react to it and how I feel about it is going to be based largely on that, on me, the viewer. So that's, like, again, and I think that that's sort of the nature of art. And what's to me so crazy is, like, you would normally have these sort of interactions and experiences at a museum or at a gallery, right? You would normally have a sort of a known space to have it. But for, like, one of the first times in, you know, in American history, you're having it at a, in a very public place while your mind is on catching a connecting flight, or the fact that you have to find a bathroom, or that, you know, United has lost your luggage or whatever, right? So it's sort of like, it's jarring just by the nature of having that context be that different. It's that much more of a separation from how you're supposed to, how you think you should be experiencing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what's really interesting too is that, so the, again, we talked a little bit about, like, the way that the art is meant to be viewed and everything else. And I'm not even making it clear enough, I think, to listeners. It's two giant murals. They are spaced apart from each other. So it looks like one mural shows,
and they're,
like,
right to left.
Exactly. So it's not even the way that you normally view something. Yeah. We're used to, in the West, at least, viewing things as a storyline from going from left to right. Right. That's the way you read things. But here it's meant to be viewed from right to left. But the issue, or kind of the weird thing, is they're really weird. It's by baggage claim. It goes between the atrium, like the main area, and then baggage claim. So it's something too that, like, again, everyone is going to see, and you're seeing it as you're leaving this airport, and it's just really weird. Yeah. So the way that our minds read it is, it shows someone going from the world at peace with all the nations together on the left. And then you go to the right, which in our brain says that's the way that time flows, is the way that a story flows. And then you see this, like, Nazi stormtrooper gas mask dude killing everybody and the world being in genocidal destruction. It does not read that way at all. Like, I don't know. It's very weird. And it's like, it's right in between it is, like, a tornado shelter, which is very funny. Like, you know, at airports, there's, you know, bathrooms are considered tornado shelters. It's super spooky and weird and very strange. And just, again, very, very interesting. Now, here's the thing, though. What the muralist says is he says this quote. So he says, there's a lesson that the lesson here with the mural is that someday the nations of the world will stop war and so on, will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning forks. That's taken from how I was brought up as a Mexican in the Mexican Revolution. That's really interesting, and I think it's a good story. But again, a little bit of editing. A little bit of editing could have helped. If this mural was from the right to the left, I think it would have been a little bit clearer. You know? Anyways. Very, very interesting stuff. So, Marie, next episode, what are we getting into?
Okay, so, you know, again, I think if it was just maybe those strange pieces of art the conspiracy theories probably wouldn't have taken as much flight as they actually have. But there's even more to Denver International Airport that we're going to be getting into in our next episode. Most importantly, the capstone, which the carved granite piece of a time capsule that, again, is has been brought to us by the Illuminati and could signify our own destruction. That on our next episode.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
Now, Denver Internet. Now, I think actually my favorite, I guess, collection of the conspiracy. We'll try again. God damn it.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.